For the first time in American history, a former president is facing federal charges. The seven criminal charges against Donald J. Trump are connected to the hundreds of classified documents found at his Mar-a-Lago resort. We'll go through the charges and what's next in the case. Plus, this indictment from a Florida grand jury is significant when it comes to a venue for a potential trial. We'll explain why, and we'll have the reaction from Trump's Republican rivals in the 2024 presidential race. Good morning, and welcome to Way Too Early on this Friday, June 9th. I'm Jonathan Lemire. Thanks for starting your day with us. NBC News can confirm that former President Donald Trump has been indicted by a grand jury in Florida in connection with special counsel Jack Smith's investigation into his handling of more than 100 classified documents discovered last year at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach, Florida. Two sources familiar with the matter confirmed the indictment, one adding that Trump received a summons to appear in U.S. District Court on Tuesday. This is the first time in American history that a former U.S. president will face federal charges. The sources say that Trump has been indicted on seven charges, with one source noting that does not necessarily mean seven counts, because multiple counts can be associated with each charge. A spokesperson for the special counsel declined to comment last night, and a separate source said the indictment is under seal, which is why the government can't say anything about it just yet. But sources tell NBC News that the charges include violation of the Espionage Act, conspiracy to obstruct, as well as making false statements. One of Trump's attorneys said the former president's legal defense team does not yet have a copy of the indictment, but the summons to appear in court on Tuesday in Miami does include language about the charges.
It doesn't perfectly mirror an indictment, but it does have some language in it that suggests what the seven charges would be. Not 100% clear that all of those are separate charges, but they basically break out from an Espionage Act charge, which is ludicrous under the facts of this case, and I can certainly explain it, and several obstruction-based type charges, and then false statement charges.
Former President Trump is expected to surrender to authorities and appear in U.S. District Court in South Florida on Tuesday at 3 o'clock Eastern. A U.S. Secret Service official tells NBC News that Secret Service personnel will meet with Trump's team today to begin security and logistics planning for his movements to appear in federal court. This, of course, is Trump's second indictment in the last 2 months, as he also faces state charges in New York and has pleaded not guilty to 34 counts of falsifying business records in a hush money case involving adult film actress Stormy Daniels. Now, news of the indictment was first broken by Trump himself. Just before 7:30 p.m. on the East Coast yesterday evening, the former president started posting a series of all caps messages on Truth Social, announcing that his attorneys had been informed of the indictment by the, quote, corrupt Biden administration. In a follow-up, Trump was the one to reveal that he was due to appear in Miami court next week, and he again professed his innocence. In a third message, Trump declared it a dark day for the United States. Later on, Trump repeated many of those same claims in a video that he posted to social media.
This is warfare for the law, and we can't let it happen. We can't let it happen. Our country is going to hell, and they come after Donald Trump. They're trying to destroy a reputation so they can win an election. That's just as bad as doing any of the other things that have been done over the last number of years, and especially during the 2020 election. So I just want to tell you, I'm an innocent man. I did nothing wrong.
Joining us now, former U.S. attorney and an MSNBC contributor, Barbara McQuaid, and MSNBC legal analyst Danny Savalas. Danny, here on set with us in New York. Let's start with you. Let's start with your reaction to these indictments and the charges that are reported to be coming. What's your take? Was this what you expected?
To me, the moment yesterday when Trump was informed that he was a target, that was the tipping point where I realized, oh, something is coming and probably very soon. And sure enough, I mean, really within a matter of hours, the indictment comes down. And a lot of the charges in the indictment were not much of a surprise. We expected an Espionage Act charge. Now, the Espionage Act conjures up images of spies and trench coats and foreign governments, but it really doesn't require that. Here, it really can just be the retention of not just classified documents, but anything that is national defense information, anything that satisfies something that doesn't have to be classified. If it is something that is national defense information, retention of that document, refusal to turn it over, a lot of these elements are overlapping. But again, a lot of these were anticipated. It really boils down to the taking of the documents, but more so, I would say, the refusal to give the documents back.
And that's the key difference here between this moment and what we found with President Biden and former Vice President Pence, as there were classified documents found in both of their homes, but they returned them. Trump was charged with evading prosecutors to give them back. So, Barb, let's talk about the charges themselves. Danny started it, but let's walk through them. The Espionage Act, the idea of obstruction. Like, what kind of, how serious are they? And what kind of potential penalty could they carry were Trump to be convicted?
Yeah, all of these are very serious crimes, Jonathan. The Espionage Act has a 10-year prison term maximum. False statements, 5 years. But actually, really, where the action is obstruction of justice. That's a 20-year felony. So, you know, altogether, these are some very serious charges. And as you note, there are seven counts, but we've only heard the description of three different statutes. And it strikes me as quite possible, based on that clip that you just played, that it's the obstruction of justice that probably has multiple counts. There could be individual counts of obstruction. There's also been reporting of conspiracy to obstruct justice. And so that requires at least one other person to either be charged or listed as an unindicted co-conspirator. So someone who helped, perhaps someone who helped move boxes or lied to investigators. It can include tampering with witnesses. It could include the response to that subpoena when a small batch of documents was turned over and yet 26 more boxes were found in the basement. So I would look to see multiple counts of obstruction of justice based on each of those different acts.
So, Danny, let's talk about venue. The action on this case to this point, up until last week or so, was known to just be in Washington, D.C. And suddenly there's this revelation of a grand jury that's been meeting in Miami as well. And now that's where Trump is set to appear next week. So just explain for the viewer here, does that mean that potential trial will be in Miami as well? And if so, what's the difference there between South Florida versus Washington, D.C.? Why did it go this way?
The trial will be in Miami, and although we may never know the strategic reasons why it seemed to begin in D.C. and end up in Florida, the most likely reason is that the government, after analyzing the facts, realized that the balance of the conduct that formed the basis for the crimes, the alleged crimes, happened really in Florida. And arguably, you could say that the conduct that he undertook while president, while in D.C., would be more problematic to indict under. In other words, the things that he did as president arguably may be more difficult to indict him for than the things he did after he was no longer the president, when it becomes remarkably much easier to indict him to determine that what he did was a crime because he's a regular civilian. So the potential defense of, well, I declassified them, no longer an option. The potential defense of, hey, well, you know, I was authorized to have these documents for whatever reason, that dissipates as well. So it really may have been a strategic decision. And I can imagine, I picture a conference room full of U.S. attorneys and AUSAs figuring out, well, look, we could indict in D.C., but then we will face a motion to dismiss. Maybe far better to not have to deal with that, indict in Florida. We have the facts. We feel confident about them. We really don't care about what jury we get because, you know, look, the jury for the government would probably be better in D.C. than it would be in Florida. Although I'm not entirely sure. I mean, this is a generally large district. You can get all kinds of folks in that jury pool. But if the government feels strongly enough about a case, they really, I think Barb will tell you, they don't care where they bring it. They'll bring it.
So, Barbara, let's talk about what the Trump team is floating as potential defenses. We know that his explanations for the justifications for having these classified documents have changed quite a bit, including the idea that he declassified them just by thinking about them. It also seems like his defense is trotting out a strategy of prosecutorial misconduct, noting that this is a charge brought by the Department of Justice that was underneath the President of the United States, Joe Biden, who is Donald Trump's top rival for the White House next year. So just walk us through your assessment of their potential defenses. Do you think any of them could work?
Yeah, I don't think either of these defenses are going to work. They might sound good in the court of public opinion, and I imagine Trump will hammer them as he has. But as Danny just said, this idea that Trump declassified the documents is really off the table if the charge is the Espionage Act, because there's no requirement under the Espionage Act that the documents be classified. They must merely pertain to the national defense. And so the government has had a chance to look at these documents. They can determine whether they pertain to the national defense. If they're talking about military capabilities or attacks on Iran or whatever they are, that would qualify. So I think this completely neutralizes that defense. And then this idea of prosecutorial misconduct, that's not going to do anything to undo any crimes Trump did. If there is prosecutorial misconduct of some sort, that's an issue to be dealt with in a disciplinary action. But the idea that, the Biden administration can't charge anybody who's a Republican is absurd. Prosecutors charge members of both parties all the time. So I don't think that's going to carry any weight. In fact, if I were a prosecutor, I would be filing a motion with the court to preclude any such arguments from going toward a jury.
An all-star legal team to start us off on this historic day. Danny Savalas, Barbara McQuaid, my thanks to you both. Still ahead, we'll have the latest from Eastern Europe as U.S. intelligence confirms that Ukraine's long-awaited counteroffensive is underway. Plus, a significant victory for voting rights activists. We'll dig into the Supreme Court's decision to strike down Alabama's congressional map. And of course, we'll have complete, thorough, continuing coverage of the indictment of Donald J. Trump, looking at matters both legal and political. Those stories and a check on the weather when we come right back.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Welcome back to Way Too Early. We're going to have complete continuing coverage of the federal indictment of former President Donald J. Trump. We now want to bring you a few of the morning's other headlines, one of which more legal trouble for Trump is some of his lawyers are seeking a new trial in the civil case that found the former president liable for sexual abuse and defamation. Last month, a jury ruled in favor of the writer E. Jean Carroll, awarding her $5 million in damages. Carroll alleges that Trump raped her in a New York City department store back in the 1990s and then lied about it. Trump has repeatedly denied the allegation. Now, in a new court filing, his lawyers claim that the former president should either get a new trial or have to pay less in damages. They want the amount reduced to about $900,000, arguing in part that the jury's findings were inflated because they did not find a, quote, preponderance of the evidence that Trump raped Carroll, only that he sexually abused her. Carroll's attorney responded to the filing, writing in a statement this, Trump's arguments are frivolous. The jury carefully considered the evidence that Ms. Carroll presented, and Trump did not put on a single witness of his own. Turning overseas now, a senior officer in Ukraine's military tells NBC News that Kyiv has officially launched its long-awaited spring-summer counteroffensive. The Washington Post reports that Ukraine's military intensified its strikes yesterday near the front lines in the southeast as it begins to try to push into Russian-occupied territory. Moscow's defense minister said yesterday that Ukraine sent up to 1,500 soldiers and 150 armored vehicles into the region of Zaporizhia, though his claims could not be independently verified. According to that post, the region, according to the Washington Post, the region has long been considered the likely location of a new Ukrainian campaign, which is expected to unfold over the upcoming months. And back here at home, in a surprise ruling, the Supreme Court struck down Republican-drawn congressional districts in Alabama as a violation of the Voting Rights Act. The court ruled 5-4, backing civil rights activists who say the new districts discriminated against black voters. Chief Justice John Roberts and Donald Trump-appointed Justice Brett Kavanaugh joined the liberals in the majority. And the map of these seven districts will now have to be redrawn. But as NBC News reports, Kavanaugh wrote a separate opinion that leaves open future challenges to the law based on whether there is a time when the consideration of race in redistricting is no longer justified. The White House celebrated the unexpected win, and NAACP President Derek Johnson wrote in a statement this decision is a victory for black America and a triumph for our democracy. A proper democracy cannot function without the black vote. Indeed, the Supreme Court had been rolling back voting rights protections in recent years. This one was unexpected. Still ahead here on Way Too Early, we're going to have complete continuing coverage of the indictment of former President Donald J. Trump. We'll be right back with that and some of the morning's other top headlines.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app. It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
Welcome back. The hazardous wildfire smoke that clouded the Northeast this week is now moving to the South and West, the air quality dropping in the nation's capital and other major cities. NBC News correspondent Emily Aketa has more.
While New York has seen an improvement from this apocalyptic landscape, the danger zone now drifting south and west.
I'm wearing a mask to protect myself because I have asthma.
We were going to head to the pool, but I was like, nope, do something indoors today.
Smoke smothering the Washington Monument, Philadelphia's skyline in a haze, as it recorded the worst air quality in the world with a reading of 444.
There was a period last night when we had very, very polluted air in the city of Philadelphia. The scale goes to 500. So this is terrible.
The smoke streaming south from Canada's devastating wildfires that have already displaced 20,000 people. The White House announcing plans to send all available federal firefighting assets to battle an unprecedented start to Canada's wildfire season, as drier and hotter conditions that experts blame on climate change send fire danger soaring.
Kind of is like apocalyptic, but I mean, I would imagine that it's probably worse in Canada, so I feel for them.
The heavy haze has canceled school, Broadway shows, and sporting events, including the Nationals baseball game in D.C. Poor visibility in the skies also prompting the FAA to order ground stops and delays at a string of major airports along the East Coast.
As soon as I walk outside, I can feel my eyes getting irritated. It smells like campfire everywhere I go.
We are constantly inhaling pollutants, but wildfire smoke contains uniquely toxic particulates with traces of chemicals, metals, and plastics.
What is happening with that particulate matter when we are inhaling wildfire smoke?
So the smaller they are, the deeper they can go into the body. And so it's the fine particles that tend to travel, can travel further into the respiratory system and sometimes even into the bloodstream.
Health officials in New Jersey reporting an influx of asthmatic patients like Grace Menendez.
right now with this air quality, notice that it just worsened like overnight.
As millions are spending more time indoors, experts say keep windows closed, recirculate air in your car and home's air conditioning, and avoid activities that would release more particles.
Avoiding dusting, avoiding vacuuming, even things like cooking, and even things like burning incense or candles actually give off particles. So I would avoid all of that.
Our thanks to NBC's Emily Aketa for that report. Let's bring in meteorologist Angie Lastman now. Angie, things seem to be improving.
Yeah.
But give us a sense as to conditions today and what's it going to look like with smoke lingers this weekend.
Yeah, so we have a couple of things going on. We're going to see some major improvements here, especially as we wrap up the weekend. Some lingering kind of hazy conditions and some smoky conditions for parts of the mid-Atlantic today. But this has all really been dependent on this weather pattern that we've been stuck in, this low pressure that's kind of been hanging around Maine. This is eventually going to move out, not today, but that wind direction will start to change. It'll become out of the southwest. And that means that all those fires burning in parts of Canada that are going to continue to burn likely over the next couple of days, we'll start to see that smoke moving away from them in the opposite direction of us. Of course, good news, but the main issue today is going to be from the Great Lakes into parts of the mid-Atlantic. That's where you'll want to still be heeding some caution as far as the air quality is concerned. But again, that pattern change is going to make all the difference by the time we wrap up the weekend. In the meantime, still over 80 million people dealing with unhealthy air from these wildfires. The worst of it focused, again, towards parts of the mid-Atlantic, Philadelphia in the unhealthy for sensitive groups category. That's a big improvement from yesterday. New York now just dealing with some moderate conditions. Still, though, there's a couple of spots out there that are unhealthy. The good news is we don't have the very unhealthy or the hazardous on this map anymore. That was long gone after yesterday. You can see how this smoke moves out, leaving us with some clearer conditions and actually a little bit of blue skies here as we get into the weekend in some of these spots that, Jonathan, have looked quite apocalyptic in some sense over the past couple days.
I think it's a step in the right direction when I walk outside and the sky's not orange.
And you can breathe.
When I can breathe. Angie Lastman, thank you so very much. We appreciate all the work on this week. Still ahead here on Way Too Early, we have so much more to cover on Donald Trump's federal indictment, including reaction from Congress as well as his challengers in the 2024 presidential race. We'll be right back with all of that. Welcome back to Way Too Early. It's just about 5:30 a.m. on the East Coast, 2:30 out west. I'm Jonathan Lemire. Thanks for being with us. As you might expect, House Republicans are wasting no time responding to former President Donald Trump's federal indictment. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy tweet incorrectly reads as if President Biden was the one who personally indicted Trump. He typed this: it's inconscionable for a president to indict the leading candidate opposing him. Majority Leader Steve Scalise says he tweeted and echoed that same sentiment. His reads in part, Joe Biden is weaponizing the Department of Justice against his own political rival. That is, of course, incorrect. The White House and DOJ separated on this matter. A Florida grand jury was the one that indicted the former president. And GOP conference chair Elise Stefanik titled her statement on the indictment this way: the unprecedented and sham indictment of President Donald Trump by Biden's Department of Justice. You can see the talking points are coalescing. Now, the only member of House leadership who hasn't yet released a public reaction is House Majority Whip Congressman Tom Emmer. A Trump ally tells NBC News that Emmer's silence has been noted. On the other side of the aisle, Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries tweeted this: the rule of law is central to the integrity of our democracy. It must be applied without fear or favor to everyone. Now, it's a different story in the upper chamber. Republican leadership is keeping quiet, at least for now, but Trump allies are speaking out. Freshman Republican Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio tweeted that President Biden is trying to, quote, preemptively steal the 2024 election. Meanwhile, Missouri Senator Josh Hawley responded in a televised interview.
If the president in power can just jail his political opponents, which is what Joe Biden is trying to do tonight, we don't have a republic anymore. We don't have the rule of law. We don't have the Constitution. Our Constitution is built on the basic rule of law and due process, and nobody should be in doubt of what's happening tonight. Joe Biden and his cronies are trying to take out their chief political opponent. This has never happened before in American history, Laura. We are in dangerous, dangerous waters, and it is because of Joe Biden.
Now, Republican presidential candidates are taking different stances on Trump's latest indictment. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, his chief rival within the GOP, tweeted last night that he'd hold the DOJ accountable if he were elected president, writing in part this: "Why so zealous in pursuing Trump, yet so passive about Hillary or Hunter? The DeSantis administration will excise political bias and end weaponization once and for all." Now, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie took a different tact. He tweeted, quote, "No one is above the law," adding that he's waiting to see, quote, "what the facts are when any possible indictment is released." Earlier in the day, before the news of the Florida indictment came out, Christie had this to say about Trump.
"These are all self-inflicted wounds. Return the documents and stop doing this. Why do you have to be the center of negative attention all the time? Why do you have to be angry all the time?" And that's what Donald Trump has done.
Meanwhile, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott was the first candidate to respond to the news on camera. Take a listen.
"What we've seen over the last several years is the weaponization of the Department of Justice against the former president. You don't have to be a Republican to see injustice and want to fix it. As president of the United States, I would purge all of the injustices and impurities in our system so that every American can have confidence that they will be seen by the Lady of Justice with a blindfold on."
Now, Trump's former vice president, Mike Pence, as well as Nikki Haley, neither of them have yet commented on the indictment. Joining us now, politics reporter for Semaphore, Shelby Talcott. Shelby, thanks for being with us this morning. So let's talk, start first with the GOP field and this sort of balancing act that it seems like candidates are trying to take. Walk us through the thinking behind the likes of DeSantis, Scott, others who are taking Trump's side, at least so far, instead of trying to use this indictment to their own political advantage.
Yeah, so I'd actually argue that while they're certainly taking Trump's side in the general sense, there is a difference between their comments this time around compared to Trump's last indictment. I think that they're more broadly criticizing what they argue is the politicization of the DOJ without outright saying that Trump is innocent. We saw last time DeSantis said, was commenting about extraditing Trump from Florida. And so there is a little bit of a different stance here from the campaigns. And I think the idea is it's safe to go after this idea that the DOJ is politicized, but this is a much more serious charge than what we saw Trump deal with last time around. And so candidates are kind of holding back, in my view, intentionally, because they understand how serious this situation is.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And it seems that, you know, some of the candidates, DeSantis in particular, part of the strategy is that Trump to be taken down by some of these legal matters. And there's so many, right? This is his second indictment. He was also found liable for sexual abuse last month, as we mentioned earlier in the show. So how is Trump's campaign planning to deal with this? There's the politics of it now, but also the fact that he might be standing trial sometime next year.
Yeah, this is what I've heard from other campaigns, too, is the idea that as the investigations ramp up, how can Trump's campaign possibly continue on a regular campaigning schedule, right? You have multiple indictments he's facing, multiple lawsuits. That takes up a lot of your energy. At the same time, they're clearly trying to. There's no plans to change his weekend schedule in terms of campaigning. I was talking last night to some people who were with him at Bedminster, and I asked, what's the mood as things wind down tonight? And I was told that they were listening to Elvis and having a late dinner. So they're clearly trying to kind of continue to focus on the campaigning and keep things normal. But I have a feeling as things ramp up, it's going to be very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, he will physically be unable to be on the road as much as he'd want because of these potential trials. This is certainly an inflection point for this campaign, and we should, of course, remember there may be more indictments coming down. Georgia, potentially even January 6th. Politics reporter for Semaphore, Shelby Talcott, thank you so much for your reporting this morning. We really appreciate it. Still ahead, we're going to switch to business news, and CNBC joins us with this morning's big headlines, as well as the latest from Wall Street, where the markets are mixed this morning before the bell. We'll have that business news and then more on Donald J. Trump's indictment when Way Too Early returns.
Time now for business. And for that, let's bring in CNBC's Arabile Gumede, who joins us live from London. Good morning, Arabile. The S&P 500 is headed for a fourth straight week of gains, while overseas in Europe, the economy is facing real pressure where you are. What's the latest?
Yeah, so things have certainly shaken up just a little bit, right? So markets in the United States are perhaps taking a little bit of an advantage ahead of some news coming out next week, whether it be those CPI numbers, whether it be, of course, the Fed and their interest rates decision, which could even be a pause in interest rate hikes as opposed to another hike. But that pause isn't also necessarily the end of that hiking cycle, as is to be noted. So the market perhaps playing a little bit of a catch up, of course, ending at its best level for 2023. That's the S&P 500, so really notching up some positive numbers. While over in Europe, though, well, it fell into a recession, particularly in the first quarter of this year. 0.1 no expansion. 0.1% is that figure, negative 0.1%, which follows on from the negative 0.1% figure that was seen as well in the final 3 months of last year. It is a revised number for the first quarter, though, because that was initially a positive number that came out of Eurostat, the official body to deliver that those numbers. They've revised that down because the likes of Ireland, the likes of Germany, as well as the likes of Greece and the Netherlands have all dropped off as well when it comes to their revision for growth. So negativity, unfortunately, on the economic front in Europe.
So, Arabile, we've been talking all week about Saudi Arabia's move into professional golf here in the United States, but one person who spurned Riyadh is Lionel Messi, who decided to take his talents to South Beach as he's coming to the United States and in particular the Miami Club and joining Major League Soccer in a couple of months. And there's already seemingly a Lionel Messi effect. Tell us how Major League Soccer here in the U.S. has already benefited financially since the superstar came up to announce he's coming over.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a massive, massive impact, right? He's decided not to take the multi-billion-dollar deal that he would have gotten with the Saudis and headed off to the United States, to the MLS instead. And already ticket prices for Inter Miami, the club he's set to join, which are ranked 15th, or should I say last in the MLS, those ticket prices have gained at least 1,000% and more in some cases. And that is just for the lowest tier of tickets. And if I run through just some of these numbers. Inter Miami's first league game against Mexico City's Cruz Azul, which is an away game. It's stated to be Messi's first game on July the 21st. Well, that's already pretty much been sold out. And that ticket price jumped from $29 to $459 a pop. Then that's for the lowest tier. I mean, Messi is said to earn around $130 million for the year. And I'm pretty much sure that those ticket prices might end up paying for all of that as well.
There is a sense that Messi could have had a couple more years of high-level competition in him in Europe, perhaps, but we'll be glad to have him here in the States. CNBC's Arabile Gumede, live from London. Thank you so very much. Have a good weekend. Still ahead here on Way Too Early, we're going to continue to follow the latest developments on the federal indictment of former President Donald J. Trump. We're going to take a look at why prosecutors are choosing to bring the case in Florida and not Washington, D.C. Way Too Early. We'll be right back with that. Welcome back. Former federal prosecutors described the decision to charge former President Trump in Miami as strategic. The New York Times is highlighting how moving the case to Trump's home state of Florida, which has become a red state in recent cycles, lessens the likelihood that Trump will claim he can't get a fair trial due to political bias. The newspaper points out that the jury pool in Miami and around nearby Mar-a-Lago, that's in Palm Beach, is likely more diverse in political ideologies than a pool that would come from Washington, D.C. And a dispute over venue would have likely triggered a protracted legal battle, so DOJ is hoping to avoid that. Joining us now, someone very familiar with the jury pools of South Florida, state attorney for Palm Beach County, Dave Ehrenberg. Dave, great to see you. We're going to talk about venue in a second, but first, let's just talk about the charges themselves, your take, and explain to the viewer, is it matter or not if Trump, we know he has, he's being charged with having this classified material, does it matter or not if he showed it to anybody?
Good morning, Jonathan. Well, the dissemination of classified material would come under the Espionage Act, and he's going to be charged under the Espionage Act, 18 U.S.C. 793E, And that can get you up to 10 years in prison. And there's two parts to it: disseminating it, showing it to people, or just not returning it upon request. And that's an important charge here. But the most serious charge is the obstruction. That'll get you up to 20 years in prison. And then there's a conspiracy count apparently involved here. And Jonathan, that to me is the biggest question. Conspiracy means there's an agreement between two or more people to commit a crime. Well, who's the other person or other persons involved? Because it could be, is it Mark Meadows? Is it Walt Nauta, the valet, who, according to reports, was told to move the documents before the feds got there? So we're still going to see a lot more coming, especially if it's a speaking indictment by the feds, which will set out the facts of what happened.
And we should learn all of that on Tuesday, of course, in Miami. So let's talk about Florida and this idea of venue change. You know, up until this point, up until about a week ago, we were all so solely focused on Washington, D.C. when it came to a grand jury, when it came to DOJ's probe there about the former president, January 6th, yes, but also the classified documents part. And then suddenly we learn of this Miami grand jury, and that is where charges are brought. So talk to us about that decision and what you make of what that venue could mean going forward.
Yeah, well, the DOJ can keep a secret, Jonathan. None of us knew about this grand jury. They certainly didn't tell us state prosecutors about it. And they did this in secret, and here we are. Now, prosecutors clearly would rather have this case in Washington, D.C. rather than down here in South Florida. You know, Washington, D.C., they voted 92% for Joe Biden to 5% for Donald Trump in 2020. In Palm Beach County, they voted 43% Donald Trump. And in Miami-Dade County, they voted 46% for Donald Trump. So you can see why the jury pool is better for prosecutors in D.C. But there are two reasons why this case is in the Southern District of Florida. First, prosecutors have to bring charges against defendants in the jurisdiction where the crime took place. It looks like the obstruction clearly took place at Mar-a-Lago in the Southern District of Florida, as well as the espionage. And filing in South Florida eliminates Trump's inevitable venue challenges in court, as you pointed out. That could have undone the case before it ever got started. At the very least, it would have delayed the case. And also, there's a second reason, Jonathan. I think it's because Jack Smith wanted the public to buy into this. He's a career prosecutor appointed by an apolitical former judge who's now the attorney general. And I'm sure he bristles at accusations that this is a political witch hunt. And to show this is not political, he wanted to go into a red state, Donald Trump's home state, and get an indictment. It's a bit of a gangster move, and it's going to be harder to get a conviction, but not impossible.
So, Dave, let's talk briefly about Trump's possible defenses. He's been floating of various explanations on Truth Social over the months. But when they're in that courtroom, what do you think his teams will say, and how effective might they be?
I think he's going to lean into the fact that as president, he has wide latitude to declassify documents. And that's why prosecutors seem to work really hard to debunk that declassification defense. And if it's true, they have this recording of Donald Trump on tape admitting that he knows about the declassification rules and that this is not just some Jedi mind trick that he created where he can just declassify things in his mind or has a standing order to declassify things, then that's going to hurt Donald Trump. And I think that's what prosecutors are waiting on. That was the final piece of the puzzle. And then there's also the chance that Donald Trump could count on what's called jury nullification, hoping you get a couple of Trump supporters on the jury who just won't want to send their guy into the hoosegow. And, you know, if you think about it, if he's being tried in Miami-Dade County, where 46% of the voters went for Trump, that's 5.5 out of 12 jurors on the panel that are Trump voters. So Trump is probably thinking he likes his odds there.
The right man to talk about legal proceedings in South Florida, State Attorney for Palm Beach County, Dave Ehrenberg. Thank you so much for joining us today. Up next here on Way Too Early, we'll take a look at the Axios One Big Thing. And then ahead on Morning Joe, much, much more on the first ever federal indictment of a former American president. Plus, a member of the House Judiciary and Oversight Committees, Congressman Jamie Raskin, will join the conversation. And we'll have live reporting from Ukraine as Kyiv finally launches its long-expected counteroffensive against Russia. Morning Joe is just moments away with all of that.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.